Welcome to African American Conservative, your source for political news and commentary from a cultural and right-of-center perspective. African American Conservative, the soul of the conservative movement.
Today's sponsor is audibletrial.com. They have more than 180,000 audiobooks and spoken word audio products. Get a free audiobook of your choice at audibletrial.com/AACONS. That's audibletrial.com/AACONS.
Eric Bolling is a Fox News Channel personality and co-host of the highly rated show The Five and his own weekend program, Cashin' In. He frequently appears on other Fox programs, including substitute host for Bill O'Reilly on The O'Reilly Factor. His new book is entitled Wake Up America, The Nine Virtues That Made Our Nation Great and Why We Need Them More Than Ever. Welcome to the show, Eric.
Oh, Marie, thank you so much for having me.
Just like about every one of us, you once dreamt of a career as a professional athlete, and just like most of us, that dream did not come to fruition, although in your case, that was due to an injury rather than a lack of talent. Interestingly, you are also not alone in achieving a great career outside of sports. Dr. Thomas Sowell, for example, may be considered America's leading conservative economist today, but in 1949, he was one of many young men failing in his tryout for the Brooklyn Dodgers. Just as one may wonder if Dr. Sowell would chuck his stellar academic career to have been a better fielder that day, one may also wonder if an Eric Bolling, despite his great success in finance and media, would give it all up for another chance to play for the Pittsburgh Pirates. Would you?
Marie, wow, I've done so much media, and this is the first time that question has been asked. It's a great question. Let me tell you.
Thank you.
Look, you're 100% right. I came from a poverty background in Chicago, inner city Chicago, and I'm blessed to be sitting center seat on the Five every day, and the path was a bit rocky on the way there. But you point out the baseball career. That's all I wanted to do. I wanted to be a professional baseball player, and I was drafted, and I made it. And 2 weeks into that, I blew my rotator cuff and had to go find another way, get up back on the horse and go find it, make it happen. But, boy, would I turn it all in for another shot at baseball and have my rotator intact? Probably. Can I be honest? Probably. And I'm very fortunate where I am right now. But, yeah, I'd like to be playing third base. My career would be over by now. I'm 53. But, boy, I would love to have spent 15 or 17 years playing ball. Yeah, that would have been great.
It says on the book jacket for Wake Up America that it, quote, identifies the nine core virtues of our nation and demonstrates why each one is so important to our history and our future, end quote. What inspired you to write such a book, Eric, particularly at this time?
Well, it's my first book, it's my only book, and for many years people have said, we really like what you're saying, we like your conservative voice, and they said, write a book, and I said, it's got to be at the right time, it has to be at the absolute right time, and I feel now is the right time. We've become such a divided country. The progressive left, headed by Barack Obama, has pulled us so far left and so fast, makes our head spin. Now, as a conservative, my concern is that if we don't stop the slide left, we may never get back to it. And so I wrote the book as kind of a roadmap back to the center right, which I think the country was not only founded on, but for 240 years has been a phenomenal way that's produced jobs, it's produced wealth, it's produced curing diseases, it's produced a country that can go and help out other countries when they're in need, for whether it's an earthquake or a tsunami or flood or fire, whatever. But the engine is still the America that I knew and grew up on, and I think it's still there. But I think liberal and progressivism is really taking its toll on the country, on conservatism. And I'll tell you, I've done a few book events to talk to people out in Florida and Pennsylvania and in New York, New Jersey. There's a huge conservative voice that feels that they've been told to shut up, to stop talking, that it's not your turn. They want their turn back. They want to talk again. They want to be heard again. So I wrote the book. Honestly, it's been an amazing outcry. We just hit in the first week on the bookshelves, the New York Times bestseller list, which was just a fantastic honor.
Congratulations. And you're right, that message is so needed. One of the virtues you say America needs the most is grit. How do you define grit? And why do you say, quote, we value grit less every day, end quote?
Yeah. So I started the book, I just started writing what I thought would be the most important virtues or values that the country was founded on. I ended up with 9 of them. I didn't plan to have 9. It's just the way it ended. Then I had to figure out in what order do I write these. And grit really was important to start with grit, because I think it's one of the most fundamental things about America is that if you continue to try and work hard, even if you fall off the horse, even if you blow your rotator cuff two weeks into your professional career, if you continue to work hard and strive, that gritty determination to succeed will eventually allow you to in America, because the place is just loaded with opportunity. My mom, this is the true story, on her deathbed, on her last two words, leaned over into me and pulled me close. And the last thing she ever said on this planet was, never quit. And that, I think, is what I was writing, was trying to get to when I wrote that chapter on grit. I never quit. Like I said, we were dead poor in Chicago, inner city Chicago, and now I'm very successful. I'm very happy, but it's because I never quit, and I remember that. So grit was really the reason, the way to start the book.
Fabulous. In Wake Up America, you give a series of what you call hypotheticals that may occur should Mr. Trump lose his race for the presidency. For example, you wrote, quote, President Hillary Clinton invents a crisis in order to achieve a longtime liberal policy goal. She declares that gun violence is a national emergency that threatens us all and sets the Department of Homeland Security to the task of confiscating all firearms from law-abiding Americans until the problem is solved. Yet the government is careful to point out that this is not a permanent gun grab. Citizens deemed trustworthy and obedient by the federal government may be able to get their guns back once the government determines the crisis is over, which will be between sometime now and never, end quote.
Right.
Why do you believe such a gun grab by a Clinton administration may be possible, and what do you foresee as the consequence should she succeed?
So that is – okay, so I write the 9 virtues, right? I finish writing the 9, and then how am I going to really get people's attention? What do I need to do to make people – the book's called Wake Up America. How are we going to get them to the point where they're caught, they're hooked, and they can read the book and understand what I'm talking about? And I came up with an idea. It's kind of what you outlined. It's hypotheticals, but it's an apocalyptic, almost a horror scenario where Hillary Clinton is being sworn in, and we have Al Gore as the Secretary of Energy, and we have – the communist Bernie Sanders is the Treasury Secretary and the senior economic advisor to the president. And people, I wanted people to be fearful of that, because I believe that could actually happen. So I wrote it that way. And then at the end of that first, it's called the introduction. At the end of the introduction, I say, it doesn't have to be this way. This is hypothetical, and we can solve this. Continue reading the virtues, and this is the roadmap back away from that. And so that's why he did that. It's complete hypothetical, but the actual virtues are solid ideas, thoughts, personal stories, politics mixed in with the founding fathers' meaning for some of these things. So that's where the book starts, and then I get into the virtues. Can I also point one thing out? When I finished writing the book, the publisher said, "We love this book. This is fantastic." Now, who are you going to dedicate this to? Your wife, your family, your son, your parents, they're gone, but you're going to dedicate it. And I said, no, let's dedicate this to Barack Obama. It's because of him that I wrote the book, and it's because of him that it was so easy to write, and it flowed, and the virtues flowed, because those virtues are under assault and under attack because of our president and his liberal crew. And I just wanted to make sure that he got credit for the book.
Wow. That's a gritty move.
That's a gritty move. I like what you did there.
You wrote that, quote, the liberal push for sanctuary cities arguably comes from lack of pride, end quote. How so?
So pride is another virtue, and I'm concerned that national pride as well as individual pride is being frowned upon. We have in the university system, we're putting safe spaces where people can burn the flag. Meanwhile, hundreds of thousands of Americans have died protecting the flag. Well, also, I'm concerned that we're pride in what we have. I am a believer in nationalism over globalism, and the way you get to nationalism is national pride, and the way you do that is by protecting our borders. So I love the idea of firming up our borders and also throwing out the sanctuary city laws where people can come over here, become illegals, and then hide in a sanctuary city and never get deported. I think it's a dangerous, dangerous concept, and I think it will be one of the unraveling of American society if we let it go on.
You're absolutely right. I'm in the Bay Area where the Kate Steinle case unfolded tragically, and to see that happen is just a travesty of justice, absolutely.
That's true.
Speaking of immigration, many of us were a bit worried for you that day when, during a debate on immigration, Geraldo Rivera threatened to knock you out on the five. But in Wake Up America, you recount a story involving a physically imposing traitor that makes us wonder if our concern should have been for the 70-year-old journalist instead.
Yes,
what
you should.
That's
the concern. So Geraldo, in a debate over the wall and the southern wall that Donald Trump proposed, started saying that Donald Trump was he's a sensationalist and something else. And I said, well, coming from a guy who's made a career out of sensationalism, that's rich.
Yeah.
And he got so mad he threatened to take me outside on air. And I said to him, like, all right, Geraldo, we'll take care of this in the break. Sure enough, when the break came, everything seemed to be A-okay. So that went away. But you're right. Yeah, there have been times in my career where I've had to stand up and fight for what's mine. The example you're talking about is when I was a guy in the trading pit, young guy. After baseball and after a couple of years just trying to find my way, I ended up on the trading floor in the New York Mercantile Exchange in the rough and tumble world of energy trading, the pits. And literally there's 300 or 400 men, because there were no women there because it's just so physical, so harsh. 300 or 400 men in a round circle fighting for, you know, recognition and trading, trying to do a trade at the same time fighting to be seen. At one point, the market got so busy, half this trading pit, maybe 40 or so guys fell, and we all fell to the bottom in the middle. And I'm laying at the bottom, and I see the two guys, these two big traders, laughing. They thought it was funny that this young guy who's just trying to make ends meet, had no money at the time, laughing. And it just, something happened, and I got crazy, and I just popped up, and I charged up the stairs to the top of the row that he was standing on, and I grabbed him, I threw him out, and we both go flying out of the pit off the backside of it. We end up on the ground, and we end up in a brawl. We get separated, and he doesn't get fined. I get fined $5,000, which I didn't have, and three days suspension, which I needed to go make the money back, and that happened. So I go home. I come back after my 3-day suspension, and I had so much respect from the rest of the pit because everyone knew that guy had that coming for years. He had been doing that to other people. I just happened to do it at the right time. Throughout the book, I talk about personal stories, and there are like certain moments in my life when I was in college at baseball and hit the home run off the starting pitcher for the Pittsburgh Pirates. I knew I was going to get drafted. When I applied for a job, I came up with an idea that I knew I was going to get the job with Mobil Oil. And then this one you talk about, at that moment, I realized that, you know, standing up for yourself was important, is an important American value and virtue, and I did it there. So there's moments in life, and you got to be willing to take the swing at the ball, and I did.
That's right. One of the virtues you listed, Eric, perhaps the one that means the most to us and to our country, is providence. Quote, the belief in a role for faith in our own lives and the life of our nation, because there are things bigger than self or state, end quote. Despite this being such a core American principle, you point out, quote, the hostile leftist agenda to undermine faith, end quote. Is America beginning to suffer from Christophobia, if you will, in your view?
Yeah. So and I ended the chapter, that's the last virtue, on that because it means so much to me. Like I said, coming from where I came to end up where I am is like, It couldn't be just me. It had to be some sort of my God, the God I believe in, I think, lit the path for me to end up here. And for that, I go to church every single day before the five. I go to St. Patrick's Cathedral, and on Sunday I go to to Catholic Mass every Sunday too. So I spend 6 days a week in the church praying, and here's the one step further. I talk about it on TV. There are a lot of people who are very holy people and do it, but I don't know anyone that's willing to put it front and center the way I do on TV, on Fox, on The Five, on the other shows that I host. I fill in for O'Reilly. I'll be the first to say I go to church every day except Saturday, 6 days a week, and I'm proud of it. And people will say, oh, you know, what do you think? God is telling you what to say. That's why you're successful. And I say, no. It's a confidence that I have knowing I've been there, knowing that I've spent my time praying, spending my moments with the good Lord above. And that's important to me, and it was important to me to say it in the book. It's also important to me to do it on TV. So I had to put that in the book. And frankly, it's one of the most asked about of the virtues.
Oh, that's so absolutely right. The role of faith. I'm also a Christian. I also am very open about it on air. And I think it's not just something you do, it's something you are. It infuses everything that you do. It's like air. It's like breathing. And for people of faith, I don't think that people who don't have that understanding realize how important that is.
Like I said, it's the confidence on air that I know I've been there. You know, I've been to church, I've prayed, and I'm good. If there have been a handful, literally only maybe five or six times that I've missed, maybe seven, who knows, in 5 years on The Five, and it's for whatever reason, traveling. We just get back from a location, and it's literally showtime, and I got to get there, and I feel empty, like I feel lost, I feel unprepared. I haven't been there yet. I haven't made my stop at St. Patrick's. I really need to do that on a personal level. So for me, yeah, it makes a difference. It really does.
Yeah, it's plugging into the power source.
Yep, no doubt.
One favorite passage in Wake Up America may be, quote, "At their core, leftists are collectivists. They believe that individuals should conform to the will of the whole, purportedly for the good of all," end quote. You add this, quote, "this collectivist approach to governing, though, comes at a very, very steep cost," end quote. What is this cost, in your view, Eric?
Well, I think we've become a nation of wussies. I think we've told young people that it's okay if you don't succeed, we'll take care of you. You can stay on unemployment, you can get health insurance for free, you can get everything you need for free if you're having a hard time. We've become soft. The rest of the world is going to eat our lunch. China, Brazil, even Russia doesn't have that. So I think this collectivism, this leftist, not lean, but dragging us so far left, is going to soften us to the point where we start to lose our number one status, number one power source, and that'll hurt everyone. I mean, that'll hurt innovation, that'll hurt our ability to fight disease, our ability to help other countries in their times of need too. So I think the book was written at the right time to lock those down to make sure people realize you don't want to lose those. These are things that we need to hold on to and nourish and flourish and make sure that we don't let them slide away. So that was the reason, the impetus behind the book, and I think it's one of the common themes there too.
That's right. You mentioned China several times in Wake Up America. You warn the reader about China and our lack of response to the danger posed. For example, we say, quote, "China walk all over us when it comes to currency manipulation," end quote, and later take the White House to task for serving the Chinese dictator a lavish state dinner. What changes would a President Bolling make in Chinese-American relations?
Well, I think, first of all, first and foremost, we would have to rein in. Look, you may not like Donald Trump, you may love Donald Trump, but one of the things he has pointed out is that our globalist agenda that Republicans have oversaw, have sat above and promoted, is a problem. Like I said earlier, I'm a nationalist. I think we should look out for what's best for our country, not what's best for the good of the globe. And one of those things would be to negotiate better trade agreements with China, Brazil, Russia, and the rest of the foreign countries. I think we give them a free pass on a lot of things. We let them charge us for import tariffs. Meanwhile, we let them dump cheap goods into America, and also to steal our intellectual properties. And we don't hit on them hard that way. Those are the areas we need to tie up. As far as currency manipulation, I just simply mean I'm for freer markets across the board. So we let our currency float. We don't play games with our currency. I think that they should do the same.
You mentioned Donald Trump. You have a reputation for being a friend to and a strong advocate for Donald Trump. And some in the blogosphere love you for it, while others have referred to you with several non-repeatable nicknames, which we're sure were meant affectionately because of it. Given his reputation, what is your relationship with Mr. Trump, and what message do you have for your critics in the hashtag Never Trump camp?
My relationship with Trump is I've known him for 15 years. He wrote, in all full disclosure, he wrote a blurb. He wrote a quote for the back of the book saying, Wake Up America is a huge book. It'll help to make America great again. So he read the book. He liked it, and he was willing to do that. I've known him a long time. I've been advocating for a change in D.C. for a lot longer than I've known Trump. I just don't like the Washington insiders on the left or on the right. I've been called many, many names by in Washington establishment elites because I push back on their agenda as hard as I do on the liberal agenda. So that said, the name calling is it's okay. I take it as at least I'm getting through to someone. If you're not going to vote for Donald Trump, then you're voting for Hillary Clinton, period. So you're never Trump people that decided that you didn't like Donald Trump. You're basically just you're saying you're in favor of a Hillary Clinton. And which doesn't surprise me because a lot of those people are the establishment Republican rhinos that I mentioned that hate me because I'm pushing back on what they've done to D.C. and to the country too. So, fine, don't vote for Trump, but then that means Hillary and good luck with your First Amendment, Second Amendment, and all the other things we protect as Americans because she will be as liberal as Obama, including all our federal judges and Supreme Court. So be careful what you wish for. You might get it, Never Trump people.
Now, speaking of Mr. Trump, a few days ago as we record this, we saw a horrific event at a protest following the controversial police shootings of two black men in which five Dallas police officers were killed and many others wounded. As disturbing as the shootings were, it was also disturbing that so many, especially in the black community, celebrated the shootings, putting celebratory tweets on the internet as they watched the news as if they were watching the NBA finals. Mr. Trump says race relations have gone backwards under President Obama. Is he right in your view?
Well, I think he is. And I've been saying this for prior to Donald Trump getting into the race, that you look at what's going on in America under what was supposed to be the first post-racial president, Barack Obama, race relationships are barely the worst they've been since the 1960s. So a 50-year period where things were better, now they seem to be back to where they started 60 years ago. It's 50 years ago. It's very scary. And I don't really understand why it has to be that way. I do think that President Obama, the events you're talking about, the Dallas police situation, prior to Dallas, there were two horrendous, horrendous things that happened. The Minnesota shooting between the police and the African-American and the one in Louisiana. We didn't know, and we still don't really know the details surrounding those two shootings. If they were bad cops, they'll be prosecuted. But for President Obama to come out before anyone knew the details surrounding those two incidents and start saying that this has to stop, he put a target on police officers. Now, within hours, I think 2 hours after that speech, five police officers were gunned down in Dallas. I'm telling you, there's no coincidences there. And I think it's a very dangerous place. So I think – race relations in America have slid to levels we haven't seen in 50 years, and that's because of President Obama. And unfortunately, it doesn't look like it's going to get any better under Hillary Clinton if she were to become president.
That's absolutely true. If you're just joining us, our guest this segment has been Eric Bolling. His new book is entitled Wake Up America, The Nine Virtues That Made Our Nation Great and Why We Need Them More Than Ever. Eric, what's next for you and how else can we continue to follow your work?
Wow, that's a great question. I don't know. I literally just, like I said earlier, the path has been lit for me by my creator. I'll just see where the light leads. But right now, the book is a New York Times bestseller. The first week it was on the shelves, which is fantastic. The conservative voice seems to be wanting to read something, wants this roadmap, and so I'll follow it wherever it leads. I, I don't predict. I never thought I'd be where I am right now. If you asked me when I was 22 and I just blew my shoulder out, I thought it was the end of the world. And you know what? It wasn't the end of the world. So I'm blessed, and hopefully the right path stays lit.
Well, congratulations on the book. Thanks for being our guest today, Eric.
Thank you so much.
Audible is offering our listeners a free audiobook of your choice and a free 30-day trial membership. Just go to audibletrial.com/AACONS and choose from over 180,000 audio programs. Download a free title and start listening. It's that easy. Go to audibletrial.com/AACONS. That's audibletrial.com/AACONS and get started today. Why Audible? Audible content includes more than 180,000 audio programs from the leading audiobook publishers, broadcasters, entertainers, magazine and newspaper publishers, and business information providers. You can get books from some of your favorite ACONS guests, including Alan West, Kirsten Powers, Peter Schweitzer, and others. So go to audibletrial.com/AACONS today.
Bill Kirpin is the president of American Commitment and a leading free market policy analyst and advocate in Washington. Prior to joining American Commitment, he was the principal policy and legislative strategist at Americans for Prosperity and has worked at the Free Enterprise Fund, the Club for Growth, and the Cato Institute. Mr. Kirpin is also a nationally syndicated columnist, chairman of the Internet Freedom Coalition, and author of the 2011 book, Democracy Denied. Welcome back to the show.
Hey, great to be with you. Thanks for having me.
You recently wrote an article for AmericanCommitment.org entitled, quote, "A Sad Day for the Internet," in which you criticize the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals' decision to uphold President Obama's net neutrality regulations. This decision, as you pointed out, reclassifies the Internet as a public utility. How does that reclassification affect personal Internet users, as well as those of us who use the Internet for business?
Well, it really marks the end of two decades of the Internet being an unregulated free market, really starting mid-1990s when the Internet was initially privatized. There was this bipartisan consensus that we didn't know where this technology was going, we didn't know what was possible, so we were going to take a step back, we weren't going to tax it, we weren't going to regulate it, we were going to have government kind of stay on the sidelines and let this sort of experiment play out. And I would suggest that those two decades have been an unbelievable success story, both in terms of the things that have happened economically with the Internet, also the level of innovation, the platform for free expression, and so forth. What this decision does, the order from the FCC and now this decision upholding it, does is it ends that two decades of the Internet being an unregulated free market. It says from now on, the Internet's going to be tightly regulated, subject to oversight by the Federal Communications Commission, based on a very vague Internet conduct standard where they've basically given themselves the power to say what is or is not allowed, what business models are going to be permitted, what technologies are going to be permitted, really using a model, the Communications of 1934, that was designed for the monopoly telephone system in the Ma Bell days, and the idea of a public utility needing strict government regulation. And so that's what they did. What it means for you, well, there are really two things, I would say, for you and for your listeners that this means. Number one is what we won't see. And this is a little bit hard to wrap your arms around, but we're not going to see the Internet continue to innovate and to do remarkable things. You know, 10 years ago, we never would have guessed that people would be watching streaming video on the Internet. You just wouldn't, that wouldn't have occurred to us. And I think that we're not even going to know what we're missing out on, because whatever great innovation would have been created but now isn't because you can't raise the money unless you can get the FTC permission or because the business model isn't allowed by the regulators, we'll never know what that is. We'll never know what that amazing innovation that we couldn't have thought of but would have been that doesn't happen because of regulation. And that's that we won't know what we're missing out on. That's sort of the first thing, what we want to see. We definitely will see, it'll be very obvious and very glaring, is now that the Internet's been reclassified under what's called Title II of the Communications Act as a public utility, it's from Universal Service Fund taxes, and the FCA has already voted to spend Universal Service Fund money on broadband internet service. They haven't to pay for that yet, but at least one FCC commissioner says shortly after the election he expects they'll have a vote to extend the Universal Service Fund tax to your internet bill as well. And right now on phone bills, I think that's about a 19% tax. So if you imagine something similar on your internet bill, that's going to be a pretty considerable hit to family budgets.
Few would argue against the notion that our federal government is becoming increasingly overbearing, controlling, and progressive. Hillary Clinton, for example, just gave a speech in which she promised that her administration would institute greater control over health care, and President Obama is now calling for greater federal control over local and state police departments. As many have pointed out as well, there's been over 20,000 new regulations added under President Obama. Is the call for net neutrality then simply a step in this continuing effort for bigger government?
I think so. You know, this is really a trend that we're seeing across all of the federal agencies, this trend towards sort of micromanaging everything out of Washington. And, you know, you used the word progressive, and I think that's the right word for it, not in sort of the, you know, political marketing speak of we're liberals who don't like ourselves liberals, but in sort of the older kind of Wilsonian dish of people not knowing what's best for them, and that we need to have the experts and the technocrats and the bureaucrats and the university professors tell us how to live our lives and tell us what's in our own best interest. And you know, I find that concept repulsive, I think most conservatives do, but that seemed to be the genuine motivating impulse behind much of what we've seen in this administration, and of course that will continue if Hillary Clinton's elected, this idea that people don't know how to run their own lives, don't know how to take care of their homes, their families, their businesses, need to be told by Washington, and that certainly has been motivating, I think, the agenda at the FCC, and I would suggest also at, you know, the EPA and the FDA and HHS and IRS and all of these other federal agencies. You know, they think that they're smarter and more clever and better to make decisions for the country than, you know, hundreds of millions of people making their own decisions and pursuing their own interests, and you know, I think they're wrong. But I do think they fervently believe it. You know, that's, I think, what's so dangerous about the mentality of this administration is really think it's for our own good that they're telling us how to live our lives.
You wrote, quote, "By regulating the internet as if it were a public utility, the Obama FCC is likely to actually reduce it to one," end quote. Can you expand upon what you meant by that?
Yeah, that was a paraphrase from the dissent in the recent D.C. Circuit ruling. It was Stephen Williams, an appointee, who wrote that dissent. And you know, the point that he was making is, look, you're taking regulations that were designed for a monopoly. It's one thing when you have the AT&T monopoly, there's only one phone system for the whole country. You have a monopoly, it makes sense to have tight government regulation because there's no competition. To have some mechanism for consumer interest, public interest, and so forth. That's why this body of law developed. But it's been extremely competitive free market. The vast majority of the American people, you know, 95% plus, I believe, have a choice of at least two wired providers and several wireless providers as well for their broadband connection. You go into a market like this and say, we're going to regulate it as if it were a monopoly, as if it were a public utility with tight government controls and oversight and so forth. What tends to happen is you're going to get a lot less of an investment as a consequence of all of those regulations. You're going to have a lot of an opportunity for competition to function. And you know, somewhere down the line, you're going to end up with a monopoly. You're going to end up with just one company left. And so in essence, by the government saying, we think this looks like a monopoly, we're going to regulate it as one, they're likely to take what's been a competitive market with multiple providers and actually turn it into the monopoly that they're pretending already exists.
You also mentioned that, quote, "The House of Representatives recently passed language through the Appropriations Committee which would defund the FCC regulations," end quote. Could you tell us more about that and why this is a cause for optimism?
Yeah, there's good language, actually. You know, since I wrote that, it's now passed the full House. It was in the Financial Services and General Government bill that passed on Thursday. And it's pretty strong language that specifically prohibits the agency from pursuing these regulations, implementing them. And, you know, it remains to be seen if this can get into a final bill on the President's desk. The Senate bill The committee bill, they haven't had floor action yet in the Senate, doesn't include this language. And so unless that this will be a difference between the House and Senate and something that will depend on a conference fee, or in the event they don't get that far in the appropriations process, breaks down before then, as it has the past few years, it will come down to negotiations over an omnibus spending bill. And then, of course, the question is, you know, if that language can get to the president's desk, is this the kind of issue that he would be willing to veto a bill for? You know, this bill is the bill that funds the Treasury Department and the IRS and the SEC and the CFTC and a lot of other agencies, as well as the FCC. So it would sort of put him to the test on how important these regulations are to him. I suspect he would be willing to veto this bill, or even a large omnibus package over this, given that these regulations kind of were dictated by political staff in the White House, and they're seen as an important political victory for the president. Nonetheless, I think it's important to put as much pressure on as we can, and for Congress to try hard to fight back and to show that, you know, they're not just going to accept whatever comes out of agencies and fund, you know, whatever it might be under threat of government shutdown.
On WhiteHouse.gov, it states that, quote, here's a big reason we've seen such incredible growth and innovation. Most internet providers have treated internet traffic equally. That's a principle known as net neutrality. And it says that an entrepreneur's fledgling company should have the same chance to succeed as established corporations, and that access to a high school student's blog shouldn't be unfairly slowed down to make way for advertisers with more money, end quote. Is it untrue to argue that net neutrality simply levels the playing field to give all, from high schoolers to major corporations, equal access to the internet?
Totally untrue. Actually, you know, it's interesting. The biggest proponents of these regulations, who lobbied very hard for the White House to implement them, are actually some of the largest companies in the world, and two of them in particular, Google, which owns YouTube, and Netflix. And one of the reasons they lobbied so hard for regulations is between those two companies, they consume over 50% of stream internet bandwidth during prime time in many markets, and so they're by far overwhelmingly the largest consumers of downstream internet bandwidth. And so when you talk about this idea of, you know, putting giant companies on a level playing field with smaller or upstart providers, you have to take into account the impact of saying government is going to prohibit the very large incumbent companies from being asked to pay for part of the cost of the downstream internet bandwidth that they consume. And that's one of the things that this deal does, is it's a, and we don't know if this business model ever would have made sense because no one was ever able to try it. But one of the things these giant companies feared is they feared, look, we're using more than half of all of the downstream internet bandwidth. What if phone and cable companies start coming to us and saying, look, you need to pay for some of this because a lot of our customers don't use your services, and we don't want to have to charge the ones who don't use your services higher, we don't want to pass on higher bills to everyone for the cost of services that only some of our customers use. And so some people think a two-sided market might have developed, which might have been economically rational. Now we'll never know because, you know, they sought a favor from government to prohibit that. But the principal beneficiaries of this kind of economic are actually the biggest, the largest companies in Silicon Valley that consume the most downstream bandwidth. So this wasn't any way of protecting small content providers. It was quite the opposite, a way of providing economic advantage to large content providers. And the other thing about that White House statement is it really confuses, I think, two different concepts of what they say work neutrality. And one is an engineering principle, which is the idea that any lawful content or lawful devices ought to be allowed to be connected to the network. I don't think anyone has questioned that. I don't think any internet service provider is going to violate that engineering principle in very good sense, and they have very strong incentive to do that. I've always said, if any of these scare stories about a company blocking websites or degrading traffic to them or slowing them down, if any of those things happen, they lose their customers in droves because it's a well-functioning competitive market. So those were always very unlikely to occur. But on the other hand, once you put government in charge and government bureaucrats in charge and they can act on complaints so they can decide what is and is not allowed, well, they're subject to competitive market plan, and they're much more likely to make the types of mistakes that are going to damage small companies that are innovative, that are trying something new that hasn't been done before, because necessarily know that they're going to be able to get approval, which is now be required, or else it's going to be very hard to raise money from investors to do something that doesn't have an advisory letter from the FCC Enforcement Bureau saying it's allowed, you're at great risk that they'll come in after the fact and say it violates this new internet conduct standard, which is extremely vague. And so I would suggest there was no problem for the past two decades when the internet was unregulated. There was no problem with startups or new innovators or doing new things. You just, everything that was developed and invented when the internet was unregulated, there was no problem to be solved. But to the contrary, now, where we're going to have a very bureaucratic process and there are already thousands of complaints piled up, and we're going to see as they work through what they decide, I think smaller innovative companies are much more at risk now. And I think the principal beneficiaries of regulation are actually the biggest content companies, Google and Netflix in particular.
You call for the reader to, quote, get Congress to block all funding for Obama's plan to regulate the internet, end quote. Would you expand upon this? How can Congress defund net neutrality?
Well, as I mentioned, there's good language in the House passed Financial Services and General Government bill that would do exactly that. And it takes two forms. One is that it prohibits any action on the order until its final legal resolution, and it's likely to go to the Supreme Court. We got an adverse decision, adverse from my standpoint, in the D.C. Circuit, but that'll continue litigated for at least another year or two before we get a resolution in the Supreme Court. So it puts a total pause on anything while it's still under a legal cloud. And then it also would prohibit price regulation, which I think would be one of the most pernicious forms that regulatory intervention could take. And between those two measures, it gives us a temporary pause while we find out if this thing's legal, and it stops the worst aspect of it in terms of the economic impact. I think it's pretty strong language, and I think the next sort of action item would be to urge the Senate to adopt similar language when it goes to the floor in the Senate, because the committee, the Appropriations Committee in the Senate, did not include similar language. They do have some good DC language on some other issues, including the set-top box mandate, but in terms of the net neutrality language, nothing in the Senate bill. And so really urging the Senate to do something like the House bill would be great right now, and if they fail to do so, then trying to get the House language through in conference or into a final bill would be the next step. And then, of course, trying to somehow get the president to sign it, or failing that, getting a new president who looks at the issue differently.
We've been amazed at the sycophantic relationship figures like John Koskinen of the IRS and Gina McCarthy of the EPA have displayed toward the White House, despite the supposed independence of their agencies. How would you characterize the current FCC Chairman John Wheeler's independence or lack thereof from President Obama and his agenda?
Well, the day they voted on this order turning the internet into a regulated public utility, some street artists put signs up all around town, around FCC, around Tom Wheeler's house in Georgetown. They put up these signs with his face and they said "bootlicker" on them. And this guy thought it was sort of a perfect summary of where this guy is behaved with respect to the White House, somebody who's supposed to be running an independent agency, but in fact shelved his agency's own independent analysis, expert analysis, and when the White House told him to, did exactly what they wanted instead. And this, there was a remarkable front-page Wall Street Journal story that exposed how the whole history of this rule, and basically the FCC's own experts said not to do this. The FCC had a draft rule that did not do this, that said reclassifying that is a bad idea. We're going to continue a lightly regulated approach. And they were all set to move forward with that when the 2014 midterm elections happened, and there was a landslide, Democrats got wiped out, and the political people in the White House decided this is a way we can sort of boost the spirits of our far-left activist base who's so demoralized by the election. Let's overrule the FCC, a supposedly independent, supposedly expert agency, and impose this far-left ideological agenda of regulating the internet like a public utility. And the Wall Street Journal reported they had a shadow FCC inside the White House that did all of their own work, wrote the proposal, and they sent it over to the FCC, and the three Democrats voted for it on a party-line vote.
Another figure you mentioned is Robert McChesney. Who is he, and what role does he have in the net neutrality movement?
He's sort of the founding father of this whole thing. 10 or 2 years ago, it was really his organization that he founded far-left liberal group called Free Press, which is, of course, ironically named, as all the liberal groups are, because they fight against the free press and for government regulation, really started this movement, and they did a really, you know, you have to admire the work that they did, kind of turning this obscure issue into, you know, kind of a major left-wing advocacy and organizing cause, especially when they had no actual problems to point to. You know, there were no obvious problems with the internet that required regulation, yet they somehow recruited very large numbers of what are called clicktivists, people who clicked onto their petitions or clicked to send comments to the FCC and so forth. And they were kind of the main group that put this on the map from a political standpoint. McChesney was the founder of that group. He's also a college professor now at the University of Illinois. He was previously at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. And what's interesting about him as sort of the founder of this whole movement is he's also an avowed Marxist, the editor of a Marxist magazine called Monthly Review. And he talks openly about his, you know, sort of extreme socialist agenda and so-called reform and internet regulation as an aspect of that. And in fact, he did an interview a couple of years ago with a socialist website in Canada called The Bullet, in which he said that the old goal of net neutrality was to divest the media capitalists in the control. And shortly after the housing crisis, he also had an article where he said, you know, in the end, the capitalist system by brick and rebuild society along socialist principles. And so this is somebody, it's about extreme radical as you can possibly imagine, and yet he's built an organization that has tremendous influence with this administration and with this FCC in particular. I think there were at least 90 references to Free Press in the FCC order to regulate the internet. So they were footing them constantly. An organization founded by somebody who's, you know, who describes himself as a Marxist.
Speaking of free speech, there's been great concern as of late about free speech, including free speech on the internet, especially as it applies to conservative and Christian free speech. One of our founders here at African American Conservatives recently saw his Facebook access banned for 24 hours after he linked to a Wall Street Journal article critical of Islam's treatment of homosexuals. And we've seen similar and worse treatment of conservative free speech on Facebook and on Twitter as well. It's well documented how the IRS used its powers to attack the Tea Party movement. Should we be concerned that net neutrality will give the government yet another weapon against free speech?
I think we should, and I think these issues connect with each other in an interesting way. And, you know, of course, you know, Facebook got busted for censoring and manipulating their trending news feature, as well as people suspect manipulating their news feed. And I've heard other complaints about temporary suspensions and bans. And the amazing thing to me is, you know, they got busted not just with pressing conservative stories, but one of the other things that was notable about that Gizmodo whistleblower piece is they also made the Black Lives Matter story the number one trending story because the executives told them to, even though people weren't actually talking about it at the time. And so Facebook is certainly a company using kind of its position kind of sort of as a gatekeeper, as a mm-hmm. major internet traffic source, to push a very pronounced left agenda and to suppress conservatives at the same time. And a lot of people have said, and a lot of my fellow conservatives have said kind of, well, they're a private company. They ought to be allowed to do whatever they want. And I think that that is naive for a couple of reasons. First of all, just because you're a private company doesn't mean you should be able to mislead and deceive and trick the public. There are all sorts of consumer protection laws that are designed to prevent that. And if they wanted to say what their favorite stories are or what they think is important, they shouldn't have misrepresented it as trending news, as what people were actually talking about on the site. They've called it editor's picks or our favorite mm-hmm. stories or something like that. If you're going to say that you're showing the top trending news stories that people care about, you ought to actually do that. But the other reason is that Facebook is part of the coalition that demanded these net neutrality regulations, that wants the government to regulate the internet, and that has repeatedly said we need government regulation to keep the internet free and fair and open to everyone. But if what they mean by that is the same thing they mean when they tell us that they run their own site freely and fairly to everyone. And of course, they insist there's no bias in trending news. If what they mean when they call for government regulation is actually the same thing they mean when they talk about how they run their own site, then they mean government regulation that's going to have a very heavy thumb scale for liberals, because that's free and fair and open means to them. It means free and fair and open to the liberal views that they agree with. And so the same time they're running their own site in that manner, they've been begging for the government to adopt these regulations. And for those who say, well, these are only economic regulations, they don't want to touch content, they've repeatedly said they don't want to touch content, I would point out that we're going to see a big decline in private investment with these regulations, and we're going to make up for it with our tax dollars, and starting with the expansion of universal service. And I think over time, we're going to have to pay more and more of our tax dollars to keep the Internet up and running, because with heavy regulations, there just won't be the same incentives for private investment. And once tax dollars go in, they come with strings attached. And they're going to say you've got to have public interest requirements, and you've got to have set aside space requirements for opposing viewpoints and minority viewpoints. And if you follow this to its logical conclusion, the regulations will scare off private investment. We'll start to get tax dollars. The tax dollars are going to come with public interest strings attached. And you know, somewhere down the line, it's going to be the hard censorship of you can't say these particular views that are disallowed, but I think it'll be the soft censorship of, you know, how are you scoring on your public interest requirement regulations, and have enough opposing views and so forth. And so I do think that the path that we're going down with economic regulation end up having a very chilling impact on content as well. And you know, if you think that's far-fetched, I would just point out that there's a former FCC commissioner in 2010 who voted for an earlier version of net neutrality rules, who actually said we need to look at how the networks are managed, how the networks are, quote, designed and managed to assure that the voices of women and minorities are heard. And I don't want government deciding how networks are designed and managed to make sure that certain voices are heard. I just want free market, whatever we want, and we see who wins.
That's right. If you're just joining us, our guest this segment has Bill Cox, and how to continue all your work.
All of our stuff is on the internet at AmericanCommitment.org.
Excellent. Thank you so much for being our guest.
My pleasure, Marie. Have a good one.
Thank you for joining African American Conservatives, the soul of the conservative movement. Please join us at www.AfricanAmericanConservatives.com. There you'll find information about our Twitter feed, Facebook page, and our blog. All opinions expressed here are those of this show and our guests. Copyright African American Conservatives.